We've been talking about Romans chapter 6, or Romans chapter 12, verses 6 through 8, and the gifts that Paul has here. Some of the gifts seem to be in the miraculous category, and then Paul seems to turn right around and say we're going to talk about some non-miraculous gifts. Let's go back and read Romans 12, verses 6 through 8, and then we'll pick up with what we have in verse 8, where we left off last time. And he says, "And having gifts differing according to the grace that was given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy, according to the proportion of our faith, or ministry, let us give ourselves to our ministry, or he that teacheth to his teaching, or he that exhorteth to his exhorting, he that giveth, let him do it with liberality." And then here's where the new material begins. "He that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness." Paul talks about ruling and ruling in the church, and he says that is a gift. That is one of the reasons where I see a distinction between prophecy, that obviously would have been something that was a miraculous gift, but when you think about people who are involved with, we might say, leadership, that is not going to be a supernatural gift. We know 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, that God has given that gift to elders. And Paul says that if you are serving in this capacity, you are allowed to work in this area, then you do that how? You do that with diligence. What comes to mind when you hear the word diligence? All right, there would be some seriousness or studiousness. Study would be involved with that. Anything else? Diligence.
Attention to detail.
All right, that's going to be another thing. Pay attention to detail. Anything else come to mind when you hear diligent or diligence?
Persistence.
All right, there has to be that stick-to-itiveness. There has to be that commitment, that persistence to see that it is done. Thayer, an older lexicon, defined it in this way. He said earnestness in accomplishing, promoting, or striving after anything. Those in the eldership must take their responsibility seriously and carry out their duties with zeal. Now, we would say, okay, if you're an elder, that's something that you need to do, but you might wonder too if that word is also applied to Christians, and it is. Along with what we have here in Romans chapter 12 and verse 8, we find that that same word is used in Romans 12:11. We're not quite there yet. And when Paul talks about diligence in Romans 12:11, he associates that word with every single Christian. It is thus right to say if a man is going to serve as an elder, he needs to be diligent, but that also needs to be true for every Christian as he or she lives his or her Christian life. Anything that you want to say over that little point before we move down to the next gift? All right. After ruling or after the people who are serving as elders, we've got at the end, we have at the end of verse 8, what? There are some people who are good at showing mercy. Would you say in life, and maybe you want to give a little example, have you ever seen someone, or would you say that there are some people who show no mercy?
No mercy.
There are. Let's define it first. What do we mean when we say mercy? Grace and mercy kind of go together. Grace means what?
Unmerited favor.
Uh-oh. All right. That's a good standby definition. Unmerited favor, if we simplify that maybe a little bit, put it more on everyday terms, in more everyday terms, what do we mean? Grace and merited favor is what? I give you what you do not deserve. You do not deserve any candy, any ice cream, because you didn't eat all your supper, but, you know, you ate half the green beans and you ate three quarters of the meat, so you can have some ice cream. That's grace. What's mercy mean? You broke my favorite lamp. Yes, you deserve punishment, but I'm not going to do to you what you deserve. So that's sort of the positive that God gives us as far as grace and mercy. So with that definition in mind, here is someone who can punish someone. Here is someone who can hurt someone. Here is someone who can take someone down. Are there people who will do that and show no mercy whatsoever? Yes. Where, how do we see that? No mercy.
You might see a judge in a courtroom that never looks at any of the other circumstances and just lays right. Down.
What did they call them in the old days, those kinds of judges?
The hammer.
Oh, well, I'd never heard the hammer, but I have heard of the hanging. The hanging judge. And that's what they meant. There was no mercy. I mean, you come in and, well, you know, you stole a sack of flour because your family was hungry. Out to the gallows. You're going to be hung. So in the judicial system sometimes, people come in, they plead for mercy. Don't do to me, judge, what you can do to me. Sometimes that works, sometimes not. Where else? Brian?
I saw an article this week of a
high school basketball team that was up 80 to nothing after third quarter, and the coach was criticized because they kept pushing?
Yes, sports. I was thinking initially of wrestling, but you could look at it, basketball, football, anything where some kind of score is kept, you get so far ahead that there is just no way for the other team. And yet, instead of pulling back a little bit and, you know, showing a little kindness, it's we're going to just pound you into the ground. We're going to make sure that you do not score a single point. We're going to go as far and as high and as fast as we can go. And then at the end, you know, we're just going to stand there and just say, we creamed you guys. So judicial system, sports, two superb areas to illustrate mercy. Anything else, Don?
Well, there's sports have what they call the mercy rule now. So if you're in baseball, if you're getting slaughtered, or basketball, or whatever, there's a mercy law in high school. They cut it off. So the ones that are being slaughtered, not literally, but they stop and end up humiliated anymore.
Well, that's interesting. I was not aware of that. Anybody have any more insight on that?
Yeah, that's what they do. If a certain score gets at a certain score, that just caught the game.
That's called the mercy rule. In baseball, you're up 10 runs after 5 innings.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And let's use that as kind of a basis for what we're talking about here. Is it tempting to not show mercy to some people in certain circumstances? I mean, if you've gone,
you think you've been wrong,
sure.
Rub their nose in.
Yeah, if you have waited 30 minutes in line, 40 minutes for a burger at, let's just say, Burger King, McDonald's, Wendy's, wherever you go, and you find that after you have waited that 40 minutes, and maybe you don't check your bag for whatever reason, or maybe you do and they ask you to pull up, and you find that your food is cold, you find that they shorted you whatever, or you find that they overcharged you, and now it looks like you're going to have to wait another 20 minutes to get the matter resolved. Are you feeling really merciful? Most people are not. I mean, I've already wasted 35 minutes. I was hungry. I needed to be down the road 10 minutes ago, and you have really messed up my day. It's tough when we are on a schedule and we're forced to wait for something, or it is, you know, we've tried to be really nice to someone and they have just been extremely brutal to us. The medical people are experiencing this apparently a lot more. People are coming in before doctors, you know, were nurses, they were given a lot of appreciation, but now they kind of get hammered by patients. And if you are the doctor, if you're the nurse that's being not just pestered by somebody, but you're being nagged to death and you're being verbally beaten to death, it's kind of tough to be merciful to people, because you're being attacked all day. Anything else as far as times where people struggle to show mercy? No other times. It's just really easy to be nice to the people that under normal circumstances we would be tempted to be ugly to. All right. There's some people who can irritate us just day in and day out. And maybe they do that unintentionally, or maybe they intentionally do that. They just want to see how many buttons that they can push. And it's tough to be nice to people. Gary, and then we'll take Tim or Don. I'm not sure which one.
This really specific example, but certain bus systems have designated bus stops. And if someone's running for that stop and it's raining and they just got out of a store or whatever and they're trying to catch the bus, some bus drivers will stop wherever they are closest to the person, even though it's not the designated stop. Other ones will just look at you and keep on going.
Yes, you're thinking about public transportation. If there are some specific laws, the driver might say, it's the law that I don't have to stop. And if it is snowing, if it is icy, if it is any number of type of bad weather conditions, the driver might say, I'm not required to stop, and just keeps going. But for the guy who stops, you know, maybe you've got your hands full of packages and you really, you certainly can't run, and maybe you feel like you can't walk anymore, and the guy just says, I'm going to have mercy. I'm going to stop. We are so thankful. Tim or Don, I don't know.
I was going to say the military, because 9 times out of 10, the rules of the military are pretty hard and fast. But you might have a commanding officer that even though you may have broke a rule or you were late for something, or, you know, he's either been there himself on the way up, or he recognizes the potential in this person, and he doesn't want to break this person's spirit to the point where they're not going to reach their potential. So he has a little bit of...
Yes, there are people, whether it's the military, whether it's a superior, they have the ability to inflict punishment. They have the ability to inflict hardship. They have the ability to inflict some kind of pain on someone, and they back off. Maybe they back off to the point where they are super, super nice. Well, Paul says, look, there is a gift of mercy. There are some people who are abounding, if you will, in mercy. Well, God certainly has that. When you see somebody, when you encounter somebody, you know you've messed up. You know that you have fouled up. But the merciful person does what to you? You have made an error. You have made a mistake. You are definitely in the wrong. And the person is within his or her rights to really read you the riot act. But what happens when they show you mercy? Don?
Oh, well, go ahead.
All right. We'll see if somebody else wants to take a stab at that. How do you feel?
Very grateful.
Well, you might feel relieved at first because you know that you stand condemned. You know that you're guilty. You know that you did wrong. But the person says, hey, we all make mistakes. I can help you correct that. Not a big deal. Don't worry about it. So there is that relief. What else? All right, and I think that goes back to the point that Marcia was making. There's gratitude. There is thankfulness. I thought that was going to be really bad, but they were merciful to me. All right, down to you.
Well, not all cases or situations that you should give mercy. You know, the person that needs the mercy but doesn't show any remorse at all and maintains a position that I did nothing wrong. You don't have to give that mercy to that person.
Yes.
Even God. If you're not following the commandments of God, he's not going to show mercy on you.
That's right. Now, let's go back to the text for a second. I want you to see something else. We've talked about mercy a good bit, but that's not all that we have in Romans 12:8. He that shows mercy, no period there. We've got a little more. He that shows mercy with what?
Cheerfulness.
With cheerfulness. Now, here's something that might get your attention. When you look at that word which is translated cheerfulness, as you look at that, I'll give you the spelling as far as the English equivalent letters for the Greek word. H-I-L-A-R-O-T-E-S. Yes. And you see hilarity in the original word. Now, when you're showing mercy to somebody, it's not funny, but it is what?
Full of joy.
I was able to show mercy to him. I was able to be kind. It's going to put me a couple minutes behind, going back to Gary's illustration, a couple minutes behind on the bus route, and, you know, I'm going to probably be a few minutes late for my meal, but I stopped and allowed somebody to get out of the rain. I stopped and somebody probably did not break a foot. I stopped and somebody did not drop one of their packages. You know, they had a bunch of groceries and their lettuce and cucumbers are not strewn out all over the street. I feel good about that. And it's not the wrong kind of proud, that proud feeling. It's not sin, but I gave mercy. I offered mercy and it makes me feel good at the end of the day. Margaret.
When I did shopping one day, I came out of the store and there's three ladies sitting on a bench. I said, will you please step to the curb, tell me right or left which way is the trolley stop? They said, we can't do that, we're on vacation. I said, all I need is just somebody to look right or left and tell me where the trolley stop is. They said, we told you we can't do that, we're on vacation. And they continued to sit. So I thought, okay, what am I going to do? So I go back in Black and Decker and I tell the cashier, I said, I need somebody to tell me which way the trolley stop is so I'll know which way to go. She locked her register, she came outside, she told me. She turned around and said to those ladies, I hope nobody else tries to disturb your day.
Well, you have a superb illustration there and it really cuts both ways as far as the people. You needed someone to show you some mercy, or grace, I guess you could use both words there. You needed someone to be willing to assist, and obviously the people on vacation were, but it doesn't sound like they were really preoccupied except with sitting where they were. They certainly didn't want to be disturbed from what you relayed, but that other person, again, showed you grace and mercy as well. And the feelings of thankfulness, it's the, whoosh, man, I'm sure glad that she was willing to do that kind of thing. And I'm sure she went home feeling good. Again, not in a proud and a bad way, but there was somebody who needed my help. I was in a position. Was it a little inconvenient? Sure. but I was in a position to assist this person, and I made the right choice. And that should be something that typifies us as Christians. We should want to look for times where we can show mercy to people, because if you show mercy to someone who really deserves to get clobbered, they're probably going to remember that for a long time. Exhibit A.
Well, depending on the circumstance, I guess we could say in place of cheerfulness, kindness. Because, you know, most people that are cheerful are kind. Yeah. But, you know, you don't have to go out there and laugh at Margaret because she didn't know which way the trolley was going to come.
Right.
You know, and maybe those three women weren't from that area and didn't know. They could have told her that. But, you know, this other lady, obviously she was a kind person, to stop doing what she was doing and go outside for a minute. You know, it didn't take her long, just a couple of minutes.
Absolutely right. And let's take your comment and go back to Romans 12:1. Paul said, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies what? A living sacrifice. If you are using these gifts that we have carefully sifted through, do you think that you're going to be that living, daily, regular sacrifice? You will be. And then as he looks into verse 2 and says this to his readers, and be not transformed or be not fashioned according to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You may have been a person who was not all that interested in serving and giving and showing mercy, but Paul says if you become a Christian and you're trying to alter your life in accordance with what we're talking about here in Romans 12 and elsewhere in the New Testament, this is going to significantly modify your behavior. If you were a good person, even if you were a very good person, you're still going to be changed more and more into the image of Christ. And that's the point that he wants these people to understand and drive home. You used to live in sin. We've seen that chapter after chapter in the book. This is going to be the new life. This is going to be the new you. All right, anything that you want to add or ask before we say a little bit more and then move into verses 9 and 10? Sherman.
The reference I have kind of says it shows compassion and forgiveness, which
I'm not going to do to you what you deserve. I don't have to be compassionate. You don't deserve compassion, but let me show you how good I can be. The kindness, the forgiveness, all of those things are wrapped up in that idea of mercy. Very good. All right, one other quick point, and then we'll read verses 9 and 10. And in addition to using our gifts, there are standards that need to be followed when we interact with other, and Paul is now going to begin talking about those standards. 9 and 10, Romans 12. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. In love of the brethren, be tenderly affectioned one to another, in honoring, preferring one another. Paul says to these readers, I want you to love one another. And he says, I want this love to be lacking. I want this love to not have something. What does your love need to be free from? There needs to be no
hypocrisy.
All right, hypocrisy. Anybody remember? Jesus is the only New Testament writer to talk about hypocrisy. At least he actually used that word. And when you look at where the Lord lived, there was not too distant from his hometown, a very large community. And they had, from what we can tell, a lot of acting there. And maybe, you know, I don't know that Jesus ever went to see any of the shows, but he and his dad might have worked in that area. You know, perhaps some of the stage construction. There would have been a lot of things, perhaps, that people who were handy with their hands could have done. As far as, you know, you think about today, stages and so forth, people who are involved with producing movies and other scripts in places, you know, there's always a need for that kind of thing. So he certainly would have been familiar with this kind of thing. And a hypocrite, how does that relate to an actor? Anybody remember the connection? Well, you're on the right track. You're headed. Yeah.
Hippocratic oath is medicine.
Yeah, that's medicine.
They act one way.
Yes, we sometimes refer to it as two-faced. You know, here's the actor. Maybe he's a real. You know, the clowns. Let's think about the rodeo clowns for a second. We sometimes see sad clowns, but generally, if you see the clown at the rodeo, happy or sad. Okay, Marcia can't remember. Anybody been to a rodeo lately? A clown, happy or sad?
Okay.
I'd say generally speaking, I mean, unless it's an act where sadness needs to be emphasized, generally they're happy. You know, they come out, wave to the crowd, and everybody cheers, and they're throwing stuff out and, you know, grinning because they escaped from the bull, those kinds of things. But do you think that there are some clowns in life, as far as rodeo clowns, who are really sad? They're depressed? Maybe some who have even committed suicide because they were so down and out. Out there entertaining everybody, but in their day-to-day life. So would you say that they are a hypocrite? In the sense of how this word would be used secularly, they were a hypocrite because this is their general nature. They are depressed, they are despondent, they feel down, but boy, when you see them, they seem to be on top of the world. And that's what this word is describing.
The good example of that would be Robin Williams.
Yes.
He was such a great comedian, but he had so many issues going on inside that he was not happy at the end of his life.
Yeah, I think a lot of actors are perfect. Well, I mean, that's what we're talking about 2,000 years ago. But even today, I'm so glad you brought that up. Williams, but so many others. You see people, they look so happy on TV. They look so satisfied on TV. But if you start looking at their lives, and that's not very difficult to do with the internet, X number of divorces, you know, the kids are messed up on drugs, and they have an alcohol problem. They've been in and out of rehab, and, you know, maybe staggering debt. And you start looking at the lives and you think, it's just hard to imagine that you have wrecked your life in so many ways. But if you see a movie, if you see a TV show, if there is a perhaps a Broadway play, if they're sort of headed in that direction, they always look so upbeat. But that's not the real person. It's all an act. Now, let's take what we've said, Romans chapter 12, verses 9 and 10 is where we are. And Paul says, let love be without hypocrisy. What would that then mean? All right, let's start with you, Steve, and then Gary will take your hand.
Well, maybe I'm taking it too literal, but I don't know how. If it's true love, how would hypocrisy?
Exactly right. And that is right. If this is true love, especially if this is agape love, which he's talking about, hypocrisy can't be part of that. Imagine if God said, oh, I love you. I really love you a lot. I want to hear from you. And then when you send up that prayer, what's he say? Oh, man, it is him again. Wow, let's put that at the bottom of the list. Let's deal with that one next month. People sometimes do that kind of thing with bills and other matters. How would you feel if that was God's love for you? Isn't there somebody better that we can focus on today? I wouldn't want God to treat me like that. I don't think anybody would want God to treat them like that. But that would be hypocritical love. So let's think about our interactions with others in terms of hypocrisy and love. Gary?
ESV uses the phrase, let love be genuine.
Oh, all right. Yeah, that's simply saying it in another way.
Yeah, it's purity all the way through and through. There's no fake cover or anything.
Yes. So again, translation-wise, not quite as close as what we have here in the ASV, but it does a great job as far as expressing the point in this instance. How could you show love with or without hypocrisy as a Christian? Let's look at it both ways. You show love with and without hypocrisy. Oh, okay. Here's a person who comes up and they are just super kind to you. They really hate you. No, they do. But, you know, maybe they're hoping that one day you can do something for them. So they are very, very nice. They're very, very kind. They're very, very loving. Now, the actions in and of themselves, would they indicate that there's love there? I mean, that would be your conclusion. If this person is nice to you week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, you would say, this person loves me a lot. But then one day, after maybe 25 years go by, the person finally gets what he's been after for 25 years. You think the love might change? It was feigned, fake, hypocritical. So sometimes, do you find that sometimes with young people in romance? I love you so much. And they will spend money, give compliments, spend time, and the person thinks he or she is really in love with me. But sometimes there are certain events that unfold and that person who thought that he or she was loved really finds out it was all an act. There really wasn't love. All right, let's think about it just a little bit more. Love, with and without hypocrisy. How does it work? Real life. Gary?
Well,
With love, I think of members offering to help other members, and the ones that are without hypocrisy really do help. But if you're offering to help, offering to help, offering to help, say, I love you, and every time someone asks them for that help, you say, oh, I'm not available, I can't help you, then there are those people.
I'm thinking of Facebook. People will post things on social media sometimes, you know, I have this need, and it may not be all that complicated. What do you find as far as a response sometimes from many people? I am praying for you. We're sick and we need somebody to bring supper tonight. Brother, we're going to pray for you. Well, now, is that a bad thing? No. Could it be true that the person who says, I'm praying for you, can't get out? Maybe he is sick, or maybe there's not enough food in the house. I mean, there could be some legitimate reasons for that. But if you see some of these posts, somebody says something like that, and you've got 15 people who all say, I'm praying for you. When I see that kind of thing, I'm thinking, I doubt, with at least several of those 15, that you really love the person. Number one, if you had enough time to post that, you had enough time to probably call somebody and arrange for supper to be brought over to them. You could have done something other than just say, I'm praying for you, if the person has expressed some kind of pressing need. So maybe that's just me, but I see sometimes some hypocrisy there. You know, we really love you, but somebody else can cover that. Stan?
There's the individual who takes care of another individual for maybe sometimes years, and then finds out what the will says.
Yes. Yeah, you surprised me. I thought you were going in a different direction. But let's just take the first part. The second part of the illustration was good, but let's back up to the first part, and then we'll move on. Think about the person who takes care of a spouse, child, relative, friend, whoever it might be, for years. And this care involves the dirtiest. I mean, they're changing diapers, and they, are changing maybe a bedpan, and it's just, there's a stench. And it's just difficult, hard, not fun work that requires many, many hours. This person knows that when the ill person dies, there's not going to be anything in it for them. This person, because of maybe health expenses, has gone through all the living. There is no life insurance. In fact, this person, if he or she were to look at that realistically, they might think, after I have done all this for this person, I'm probably going to have to arrange for a funeral. And I'm probably going to have to be the one that pays at least some of the bill. I mean, I am taking full responsibility for this person. I am not getting a single thing in return. There is nothing in it for me as far as on the losing or the gaining end of the stick. From the world's perspective, I'm going to lose from every possible perspective. The only thing that I can get is that I love this person and want to, show them goodness. That would be, in my mind, using your illustration, loving without hypocrisy. There is nothing in it for me, so to speak. And that's what you find with God. There's nothing in it for him. He doesn't need the worship. He doesn't need a single person. But God says, I'm still going to love you, even when you do some really bad things, and I'm going to love you without hypocrisy. Final thought there before we move a little further down. Okay, let's see what else we have here. I'll give you this quote from McGuigan. We've cited some information from him from time to time. He spoke of three different types of love. There's the if love, there is the because love, and there is the anyway love. The if love, a lot of times young people find that if you do this, then what? I will love you. Sometimes, boyfriend, girlfriend, other people looking for a friend, and that doesn't work out real well. That's certainly not the kind of love that we find in Scripture. And then there is that second kind of love, which is the because love. You are fun. You are nice. You are funny. You are smart. You are handsome. You are beautiful. And because you are, fill in your favorite blank, I love you. What happens when he's no longer funny? What happens when she's no longer pretty? What happens when they're no longer young? Well, that's why we see a lot of people getting divorced. I've said this before, and Steve will take your hand in just a second. People come and they say, we want to get married. All right? Got a question for you. Why do you want to get married? Well, they look at me like I'm from Pluto. You know? What do you think? We're in love. Well, okay, that's not the worst reason, but what happens if you're no longer in love? You know, because we're in love, that will go so far. But you might find one day that you need something else. And if you don't have the something, and maybe they do, perhaps that's just the first thing out of the mind. But if you don't have something else, chances are you're going to be in neck-deep water at some point. Steve?
Those last two things you mentioned, those are conditional.
Yes. Love is conditional.
There's other examples in that area where it's
sensitive. Yeah. And that is almost a little hypocritical. Because if a person says, I love you if, or I love you because, I mean, they're pulling the mask down a little bit. Yes, that is exactly right. Then we have love number three, and that is going to be the anyway love. You have messed up, you have fouled up, you have disgusted me, you have hurt me, you have injured me in the deepest possible way. And yet, in spite of all the bad, awful, terrible, wicked things you have done, I still what? I still love you. Do you see that love sometimes reflected with a dog? I mean, I don't have a lot of experience with abused dogs. We've had two that we kind of adopted, and both seem to have come from some kind of abusive environment. I mean, if you moved your hand in the right way, I mean, the dog would kind of, you know, shirk back, those kinds of things. I mean, we didn't hit them, but... or, you know, you tried to maybe pet a certain spot. It's kind of like the dog has a bad reaction. But even for abused animals, it's like they keep sometimes coming back for more. It's, we're going to give you another chance. We're going to give you another opportunity. You have hit me and you haven't fed me and you have done this and that to me, but we still want to have some kind of relationship with you as the owner. Sometimes dogs are more forgiving than people are. At least it seems that way to me. But when we talk about this love, that's really what we're talking about. That's how God loves us. And if that were the love that we had in our world, we'd have far fewer problems. Churches wouldn't split. Marriages wouldn't split. I mean, our world would be a much better place. Anything that you want to add as far as an additional comment there? Okay, let's go down and see what else we have here. We've got with this love and all these other good things. Paul gets to something else. What's in the middle of verse 9? Let this love be without hypocrisy. And then it's sort of flipping over the coin for just a second. And then what's he say?
Abhor what is evil.
Abhor what's evil. Abhor, we don't use that word too often. What would be a good synonym for that?
Detest.
That would be one. All right, that would be two, and I'm going to take the second answer and turn that into number one. Paul says when it comes to evil, you hate that. He's got all this love and all the mercy and grace, and now he says, I want you to hate this, and that is a present tense verb. It is also a compound word, and with that compound, it means to hate violently. What comes to mind when someone says, I not only hate this or hate that or hate this person, I violently hate. What comes to mind as far as illustrations? Violent hatred.
Riots.
All right. You think, for example, that people are upset about something and you, about a year ago, as far as pulling down some statues, I mean, he has got to come down. You know, the statue has got to go. And they're out there shaking their fists and maybe... they've got a truck out there with a chain and they say, we're ready to pull it down. What else? Violent hatred. What about war? If you have people on both sides of the opposition, you know, out there trying to shoot each other, throw grenades at each other, do they have good feelings towards each other? No. They hate people. You know, they describe their enemy sometimes in degrading ways. What else as far as violent hatred? That was going to be it's almost like playing a game show. great guess. That was going to be next to my list. But, you know, Gang A hates Gang B, and we're going to do everything that we can to kill you, to drive you into a different area, to keep you out of our neighborhood. Violent hatred. What else? Violent hate. Well, we've seen that with school shooters, haven't we? Some young people, they feel like they hate someone, their teacher or their principal or someone in their school. They feel like they hate them enough where they can bring a weapon which will end a life. And they will try, and sometimes successfully, to end a life. Well, we can understand, did you have a hand or were you? Okay.
Well, you can turn that around, that same example. When a shooter kills a number of children in a school or whatever, violent hatred can be, it can result from that on the part of the parents?
Yes.
Anyone who...
That's an excellent point, and I'm glad that you brought that up. When someone loses a loved one under the most tragic of circumstances, the perpetrator oftentimes is hated with the violence. And there have been cases where someone has brought a gun to a courthouse, and if the verdict was not what they wanted, they shot the person. You know, we just can't let them off, or we can't let them have 5 or 10 years in prison. They've got to die. And today, we've decided to be judge, jury, and executioner, and they are. Now, you have here, as you look at Romans chapter 12, 8 through 10, two very distinct extremes. That love that we talked about, you love without hypocrisy. You don't have the if love. You don't have the because love. This love is going to be something that you persist in. And now Paul completely turns it around, and he says, I want to talk about what is evil, and you hate evil violently. You are disgusted by what is wrong. The world smiles at wickedness, often calls evil good, good evil. But God says, remember back in Romans chapter 6 and verse 2, when it comes to sin and your relationship with it, God said, what's true? You have, what was sin? You have, if you're not alive, you're dead. And Paul says, you are what concerning sin? You are dead to sin. If you're dead to sin, then should we hate it? Yes. And we don't do the kinds of evil things that the world does when it hates certain practices, but we do our best to shun it. We do our best to avoid it at all costs and try to stamp it out where we can. But the world oftentimes is interested in promoting it. Anything that you want to discuss as far as that point? Gary?
The hate can kind of go the other way, too. You think of the people that bomb Planned Parenthood locations. Obviously, Planned Parenthood does things that are not right, but that's a violent hatred that's hating on the bad. Not the right way to go.
Yeah. You cannot engage in violence and still love people. You can hate the evil. You can pray for the people who are involved with it. You can pray that some things will be stopped, that some things will be changed. But love draws that line there between that attitude and the actions. The kinds of things that you mentioned that people would engage in, you just can't kind of, you can't perpetuate or in any way be involved with saying, oh yeah, you know, they went ahead and blew up the place, or I was involved with that, and it was a good thing. Sticking with what we have here, Paul says there's something else. He comes back to the idea of good. So he's talked about love, he's talked about evil, and now he says, let's talk about good for a little bit. And what does he say concerning good? Paul says, I want you to
cleave.
That's one translation. Anybody have a different word?
Okay.
All right. That's going to be a little more modern and maybe a little more helpful. Because we talk about cleaving, you know, when you think about, you know, the meat cleaver, you know, we're not talking about cleaving in the sense of chopping something in half. Hold fast to what else? Anybody?
Cling.
All right, that's going to be another one. Thank you very much. Cling. Let's use that one. Cling. What comes to mind?
Plastic wrap.
All right. You know, here's the person. He's on the edge of the mountain and he's slipped or somebody's pushed him. Or he's on the edge of the building and he's got maybe one hand or maybe both hands and, you know, 98% of his body weight is just, you know, hanging off. He's got just a little finger grip there at the top of the rock or there at the top of the building and he is holding on. He is clinging for dear life. Other people, it might be that they are clinging on to a boat that is in a body of water and they know that if they let go of that boat, they are going to die. So when we think about the image of clinging, when we think about the image of holding on to, it is that firm grasp, don't let go because it's not going to end well for you. And Paul says, I want you to have this firm grasp. I want you to cleave or cling to what? I want you to weld yourself, glue yourself, cement yourself to what? To what is good. And the Bible tells us what is good. Now, if that's true, here is something I think as far as a very practical point from Romans 12, one of the most practical points that you'll find in the Bible. This is often asked by young people sometimes in Christian homes. It's certainly asked by a number of people who are not Christians. Let's think about young people for a little bit. They want to go do something. The parents are not in favor of that. And the child, in trying to get permission, will ask what question? What is... There you go. What is wrong with it? Anybody as a parent ever hear those questions? Well, at least a few of us have. If you're looking at Romans 12, it's not what is wrong with it. From a Christian perspective, the question is what? Cleave to that which is good. Not what is wrong with it, what is right with it. And that is, I think, if we can instill that principle and that question in the minds of young people, it will make, number one, parenting a whole lot easier, and it will help many kids make a better choice. So looking at that from a positive perspective, what is right with this activity? Well, that's a little harder to explain than what's wrong with it. Anyway, maybe that'll help you. Anybody want to toss something out as far as an additional comment? Okay, let's see what else we've got here. I will give you a couple of additional examples there. As far as when life begins, that's been something that's been debated in our country for a long, long time. So somebody says, what's wrong with abortion? Well, let's turn that around. What's right with abortion when you start looking at how a child develops? Homosexuality, there have been, especially you go back into the 80s, some of our courts were dealing with pornography. There were judges who were asking, what is pornography? What's wrong with pornography? Well, the question should be turned around and people should be asked, what is right with it? Then in the 10th verse, Paul is going to return to the subject of love, and there he talks about love from what perspective. It's not agape here. It's more in the phileo category. And how does he describe it? He said, I want you to be kindly. Okay, or tenderly affection. He's talking about a lover of family affection. It means devoted to one another. You can have that agape love. I'm going to love you even though you're maybe not lovely. But here it is the sense of I enjoy spending time with you. I like to be with you. And you also have to, I think, see here that Paul is sort of piling up words for love. And when you stack all these things together, it really shows the greatest, the highest, the best regard for fellow Christians. He says God's people are to have brotherly love. Well, if he has dealt with the basic word for agape love, and he has dealt with the basic word for that second love that we talked about, and that was going to be phileo, then he needs to do it again. And here you have another example of phileo. Brotherly love means that we have that love for Christians where we prefer one another. And he says we prefer one another in honor. That is, we show deference to one another. Now, that deference is an interesting word. It can be understood in three different ways. I'll give you all three of those, and then we'll see if there's something you want to add or ask before we look at verses 11 and 12. It can mean to outdo. You find people sometimes, they want to outdo someone else. You know, you were able to run the mile in 4 minutes. I want to be able to outdo you. I will run it in 3 minutes and 30 seconds. I'll beat you by 30 seconds. So it could be that when he's talking about preferring one another in love, you're treating me this way. I want to treat you and others even better. And that's not, again, based on pride or anything like that. It's just that we want to be the best possible Christian that we can do. If that's the right rendering, it means outdo one another in showing honor. There is also a second possibility, and that means lead the way. One source translated the statement, you must lead the way in honoring one another. That, to me, makes sense. Be a good example. We should be good examples to one another. And then the word can also mean regard oneself, consider better, or esteem more highly. The King James, the NIV, they follow that choice, but that usage does not seem to be well attested outside the New Testament. But it is clear as you look at these verses in Romans chapter 11 as far as how God says to his people, I want you to treat one another. I want you to treat one another not only well, I want you to treat one another in the best possible way. That's simple stuff. That's easy stuff. But oftentimes in a local congregation, that's not what we see. And that is a serious problem. Anything that you want to touch base on before we move down a little further? Okay. I've got just about 4 minutes left, but let's at least look at Romans chapter 12, 11 and 12. Paul says, in diligence, not slothful, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer. Backing up to verse 11, Paul says, I want you to be diligent. I do not want you to be, when it comes to the Christian life, lazy. Would you say there's some people in life who are not lazy as their general personality, but if you were to look at specific parts of their life, they are lazy? I mean, if you could divide life up into 12 different sections, 11 sections, the person is diligent, the person is very careful, the person ensures that all the things that should be done in a timely and good way are. But when you get to area number 12, and it's not because that they don't have any energy left, but just area number 12 for them, that's not an area that they do well with. They're sloppy, they're lazy. You ever see anybody like that? How about taking in the garbage can? Anybody ever see a neighbor? I mean, there's some neighbors, boy, it's almost like they've got a camera on the garbage can. As soon as the garbage can is picked up, they want to run it back in. But you ever see a neighbor who has his garbage can out there 5 days after it was picked up? You know, they... maybe I shouldn't have asked that. We might have somebody here who does that. But anyway, you know, he pulls out in the morning and comes in the evening and leaves the garbage can out there. Walks out to get the mail, leaves his garbage can out there. Mows the yard, leaves his garbage can out there. I mean, he or she or they might be the best neighbors in the world, but they do not get the garbage can. So it is possible to have some areas in life. Some people are slow with bill paying. I mean, they are great people. They would do anything for you, but they are late bill payers. You get to the end of the month, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that's due the first, and it's the first. I better go ahead and send that in. I'll just have to pay a few bucks as far as a late charge. No big deal. And that's how it works for them every single month. Is it possible to be one of the greatest people in the world, but when it comes to the Christian life, that's where we are somewhat spiritually lazy? It is. We can be what the world says, or maybe even by the standards of fellow Christians, great, great people. And Paul says, do not do that. In the area of the Christian life, avoid laziness. There is no room in the church for lazy church members. Paul says, you are serving the Lord. If you look at the King James and the ASV, you do see a difference in the manuscript that we have. The ASV says, in diligence, not slothful. In the King James, the text says, not slothful in business. Again, if you were reading that and not thinking carefully about it, maybe late at night, and I think, not slothful in business. Well, as I'm out there involved with my business, perhaps I'm a small business owner, God's telling me not to slack off. Is that what the King James translators meant when they talked about business? Not talking about owning a business, talking about business in the sense of our everyday lives. We'll pick up with slothful next time, but we'll see if there's a final comment you want to make. Okay, we'll end it there for now, and like I say, slothfulness is where we'll start.